If the producer of a show is like a CEO, then the general manager is like the chief operating officer. Think power behind the throne, lots of guts, but little of the glory. Today's guest on Take It From the Top is Albert Poland, one of the gutsiest and best general managers for the Broadway community during the past 40 years. Albert's business acumen and expertise helped bring to life such extraordinary classics as the original off-Broadway production of Little Shop of Horrors, Hugh Jackman's star turn in Boy from Oz, and Alfred Uhry's Tony Award-winning The Last Night at Ballyhoo. He also founded the very first official Judy Garland fan club in 1955. Albert and I first crossed paths in 1996 when he was general manager for a little off-Broadway show I wrote with John Dempsey called Zombie Prom. Though the show didn't last long, my friendship with Albert has survived over 20 years. Albert joins me by phone today from his home in Dutchess County, New York. Let's find out what makes him tick and how following his intuition has taken him to the top.
Open with Born in a Trunk.
Albert, you always make me laugh. Thank you for being here today.
Okay. My pleasure, darling.
Well, let's start with a couple, like, you know, fun questions and then get into the juicy stuff.
Okay.
When you were a child, what was your favorite book?
Oh, as a child, my favorite book, Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales, and specifically The Little Mermaid.
The Little Mermaid. And what was it about The Little Mermaid that spoke to you?
Unrequited love. For better or for worse, it's always been a big favorite that really strums on my heartstrings, you know. And I liked it. I read it when I was homesick with the flu or some childhood disease. And I loved it so much that I read it to the class. I read it aloud. I insisted to the teacher that I be able to read it aloud. I loved the sacrifice that the mermaid made, you know, for the love of the prince. She turned to the foam on the ocean wave. I was in the seventh grade, however old that is.
Yeah, so it was something that spoke to you and resonated with you at the time.
But before that, I had always loved fairy tales. I just, for some reason, really adored them.
That Happily Ever After and Once Upon a Time, there's something you just can't miss with that. I'm going to ask you one more sort of kind of like, what if? When I think of theater, I think of you, Albert. If you could play any role in theater, any gender, any age, any vocal range, if it were a musical, what would it be?
Oh, my God, that is that's an amazing question that I've never even thought about. I don't know. The first thing that comes to my mind is Peter Allen and the Boy from Oz. You know, as somebody said in the Sunday Times, it's one of the few male roles that has the resplendency that the great female roles have, like Dolly and Mame. You know, it's just full tilt, you know, and I love that about it.
And you were the general manager on Boy from Oz. That is a show I saw several times and was a favorite of my daughter's. She wanted to see it every time she came into town.
How wonderful.
There's a theme that's developing I'm going to let you in on is when I asked this question, Dolly, you know, the female roles, they all kind of get woven in there somehow. And it's interesting mm-hmm. that you tied that in with Peter Allen. So,
mm-hmm. Well, he was a peacock.
Yeah. And he owned it, didn't he?
Oh, yes, for sure. Did you ever see him?
I never saw him live.
I saw him, I think, three times. And he was a great entertainer. He really was. He was a wonderful entertainer.
What is that definition for you? What makes an artist compelling for you, Alan?
First of all, they have to have extraordinary talent. And secondly, they need to be generous.
Mm.
And talent to me is not the skill of being able to sing, dance, and act. Talent is the source that informs those things. You know, those to me are skills. Talent is the rich source that informs how someone does all that.
Can I get a little woo-woo on you? What do you mean by source?
Just the thing inside of them that all of that springs from. you know, which is a combination of what God gave them and their experience and their understandings. I mean, so many things, you know. And the richest source I've ever encountered was Judy Garland. You know, well, as Whoopi Goldberg said, when Judy sings, God speaks. It was profound when she was at her best, you know. And I would say that, you know, a rich source to me generally is connected with God in some way. You know, the person almost becomes a medium for something that is, you know, transcendent, that's beyond what we can imagine, you know, a human being dealing with, which is probably why some of them ended up being such problematic people. You know, it was just a lot to deal with.
And by generosity, what do you mean by generosity?
Just the willingness to give, you know, to give of themselves and really ask nothing in return. You know, Bruce Springsteen is another generous performer. I saw him do a concert that lasted 6 hours.
My goodness. I would say that you have a way of recognizing when
something is very special.
When did you first realize that you had that knack for recognizing greatness?
I think when I was sitting in the Indiana Theater watching A Star Is Born, you know, Judy's performance in it, she was the most talented person I had ever seen, and I also thought she needed my help. It was, you know, the first run of A Star Is Born, so it was 3 hours and 12 minutes long, and I watched it 3 times. My parents called the police, but as I say in my book, it was too late. I had escaped.
There's a theme going on here, escaping, getting past.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, Judy was my escape hatch. I mean, before that, it had been the movie magazines, which I just lived in, and I also loved all of those vaudevillians that migrated to television, you know, and we benefited from their seasoning, you know, in vaudeville and on the stage, and we thought, oh, this is what television is like, you know. Well, it wasn't. You know, television is a bunch of cameras and technology, and the people, the first crop of people in front of it were these vaudevillians, you know, that just were, you know, the original television stars.
Right. And they knew how to be in front of people. They knew that connection. They knew how to make that connection.
Yes, yes. Mm. You know, and then as time, about 10 years later, we had, you know, we began to go into the Add Water and Stir formulaic series with laugh tracks.
Right.
You know, laugh tracks replaced the studio audience, which I guess probably wasn't laughing enough or something.
You said you were living in those movie magazines. What was the action you took to go to make those movie magazines reality for you?
Well, I think starting her fan club, you know, starting Judy's fan club. I mean, I jumped into Judy, you know. Movie stars were our honorary members, you know, like Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly, Bing Crosby, you know, Lauren Bacall. They were our honorary members, so it was like, you know.
Let's just hang on. We just need to pause for a second and just for a moment, help me wrap my head around that. How does a young man in Indianapolis decide to create a fan club for Judy Garland and then get honorary members like that? I mean, what possessed you?
I just felt I had to do it. You know, people seem astonished at the things I was doing. I didn't think that much about them. I mean, I loved it. I thought it was very, very exciting. But I didn't think that I was very special for doing it. I just thought it had to be done. So I did it, you know. And I mean, I started out by calling her on the telephone to get her permission because the movie magazines wouldn't run our address unless we had a letter from her.
What was that like?
And I had an operator, you know, that was very excited. I had a list of places in Hollywood that I thought might have the number. And she was willing to spend the time calling them. And we finally got her from Warner Brothers, you know. And And I had a typed script of what I would say. And, the phone rang, a woman answered, and the operator said, long distance is calling for Judy Garland, which was an amazing thing to hear someone say. And then this woman, picked up the phone with this unmistakable voice, and I said, Miss Garland, my name is Al Poland, and I'm president of a fan club for you. And she said, a fan club for me? How wonderful. And I just dropped my script and said, oh, Judy, I love you so much. And we had about a 5-minute conversation, during which she asked me for my address. And it ended with her wishing me a happy new year because it was the last day of 1955. And, 2 weeks later, the letter arrived. And the honorary members, I somehow found addresses for them. I remember Frank Sinatra, I read that he was on location in some town in Spain filming The Pride and the Passion, and I sent a letter to that, and he forwarded it to his secretary in Beverly Hills, and she answered and had him join the club.
Fantastic. And how old were you one more time?
I was 14.
14 years old.
Right.
Ingenuity. You had drive. You had a purpose there.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
Desire.
Lots of desire. And so that sort of made it easy to figure out what the next step was.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, my energy was, going full speed.
I remember you telling me something once, Albert. You said that something that your father, a gift your father gave you was saying no to you.
Yes, his first answer to me was no, and I would fight with him and argue and make, and state my case. And 2 hours later, it would usually be yes. And that's how I learned how to negotiate. When I began a deal and somebody said no, to me it meant definitely. I found out in my later years that he loved that process with me, which I didn't have any idea at the time. I just viewed him as an obstacle, that had to be dealt with. But he really, that was a major preparation for my ultimate career,
What do you consider your ultimate career?
General managing shows.
Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem like the thing that you wake up one morning and go, that's what I'll do. I'll general manage shows. How did you get there? What happened along the way?
Well, I've always believed in reading the road signs and going with my intuitive response to them. I hated auditions. I started out as an actor. I hated auditions. Mm-hmm. And I went to work for a huge company and learned the principles of business. And I thought, I could go back into the theater in a business capacity and I could give people jobs instead of looking for them. And so a friend of mine and I decided to produce a tour of the Fantastics, and it was on the road for 2 years. We made a lot of money. It was hugely successful, got a lot of notoriety about it in the Variety in different places, and then we produced an off-Broadway show which was not as successful, and then we did another show, and we were going to move to a smaller theater, and the general manager of the second show was the manager of the theater we were in. And he said, well, if you move, I can't stop you, but I'm not moving with you. And I said, well, who will we get to be the general manager? And he and my partner looked at me and said, you. And I said to him, if you will give me a 4-day crash course, I'll do it. And he always regretted it. he said, I created a monster, I quickly realized that I was better suited to general managing than producing, because I'm kind of a little bit in awe of artists, and I don't know how to do the kind of, alchemy that great producers can do. Great producers like Merrick and like Cameron, and that I was better as the power behind the throne, and I love collaborating with powerful people, and I'm very good at it. So I found my niche, and it just evolved.
My goodness, you sure did. Your list of accomplishments is breathtaking, and admire you so much, Albert.
You have
a wonderful combination of strength and warmth. That's a real fine line. That's a balancing act. Do you do that consciously? Is that intentional?
No, it's really me. It's, you know, that's mm-hmm. that is my expression of myself. It's not contrived, and I couldn't play act something that. That I manufactured. It's not a possibility, you know.
Mm.
I'm a very honest person. The reason I'm honest is so I can sleep at night.
It just makes it a lot simpler, doesn't it?
And my father, that's another gift he gave me. He really drummed honesty into my head. And I always thought being honest was like getting a C, you know. I thought it was like average, but it isn't. I was surprised to find that, you know, that it's the exception rather than the rule, you know.
In your life, with all these wonderful successes and everything, I can't imagine it was like just smooth sailing all the time. Is there a huge mistake that you ever made?
Not saving enough money. I have a comfortable retirement, but, you know, I wish I had put away more money, and God knows I earned a lot of money, but I spent it. In terms of shows, I turned down some successful shows, but, you know, I didn't like them or I didn't respond to them, so I wasn't the right person for them. I only regret turning down one show, and that's Cloud Nine. You know, I was offered Cloud Nine by Tommy and Michael Stewart, his producer. You know, I had a bad experience with them at the Village Gate doing Tommy's one-person show, and I said, well, I'm amazed you're calling me. And Michael said, well, I'm calling you because you're the best. And I said, well, then I must read it at least. So the script arrived with a bottle of Cristal, and I drank the Cristal. I read the script and thought it was the most pretentious crap I'd ever read in my life. And I called my friend Helen Montague in London, who had produced it at the Royal Court. And she said the critics loved it. It ran 2 weeks, and she didn't like it. So I turned it down. But there was something about Michael Stewart's confidence when he was speaking to me that I just thought, you know what, I may have made a mistake. And I ran to the first preview, and I had made a mistake. It was just exquisite. I consider Tommy's best work his avant-garde work, you know, like Cloud Nine and the Club.
Is there something that you took away?
Yeah, I learned to accept mistakes.
Well, that's huge, actually, you know. What is one of your proudest moments?
One of my proudest moments? I guess recently when I made the speech at the Howard Ashman Award presentation to Tom Viola. You saw that, right?
Didn't you? I did. I got to see the video of that, yes.
You know, it was a proud moment because they were both people who are just awesome in my eyes, and I felt that I lived up to the occasion and the task, and the audience was, you know, the audience response was almost overwhelming.
It seems like you did everything right, Albert. Mm. But if you could go back to your less successful, less wise self, is there any advice you would give to young Albert?
Not really, because I just believe my life unfolded as it was supposed to. You know, and I believe that obstacles can, you know, help us grow. And our failures, you know, lead to success. I mean, I think the unfolding of my life was really perfect for me, you know, and like I say, the only thing I would change is I would have saved more money. Save your money.
So what led you to retire?
The business changed, which, you know, things change. I mean, that's part of what happens with the passing of time. And it just changed in a way that I didn't enjoy. Instead of, you know, one or two exciting people producing a show that you can collaborate with, it became 20 people. I like a point of view. The process changed in a way that I no longer enjoyed. I stuck with it for 5 more years. And
So you've made a change. And what's it like for you now?
Loving it. Couldn't love it more. I'm loving retirement as much as I love my career, and it's the opposite. You know, it's I wake up in the morning and give myself permission to do nothing. I've written a memoir that I love. I'm just thrilled with it, and I hope, you know, my goal this year is to find a publisher. When I was in the theater, it was about relationships. I had incredible friendships that went on for decades. You know, it's now about transactions. That's the word.
Mm.
You know, more than relationships.
This is a very big word for me, relationships, connection.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a challenge in the arts and the entertainment industry to create any sort of relationship or connection that doesn't feel transactional. And where are you finding connection now?
With my friends, mm-hmm. you know, my friends of decades,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a few new ones. You know, my relationship with Jerry Schoenfeld and Bernie Jacobs, those were two fabulous relationships, and we
uh-huh.
fought with each other, you know. We were passionate with each other, and we had fabulous times. They were great fun, among other things. And those were relationships. You know, they endured, and we were loyal to each other.
Mm-hmm. You were general manager for Zombie Prom for us.
Mm-hmm.
We just met, what, 20 years ago now, just for a brief time. Mm-hmm. And there was something about you that made me think, gee, I want this person in my life.
Oh, that's very good.
And so what you're talking about is really important. You know, artists, whatever art they're doing, whatever discipline it is, it's about connection. You started out by telling me that an artist is compelling because they give and they connect with the audience. And
mm-hmm.
And writers are the same way, and general managers
yes.
are the same
yes.
way.
Yes. Well, that's part of talent. Generosity is a major part of talent.
It's great stuff. Not everybody equates it with that.
Well, who was a more generous performer than Judy Garland? I mean,
I never saw her live.
Well, you were probably not even born or something, right?
I was. You know, I was 12 years old when, I think I was, 12, 69 was when she died.
Yes.
69. And I remember standing in our living room and hearing it on, you know, we had the big stereo, you know, this big piece of stereo that was a piece of furniture.
Yes.
And it, along the wall was the length of the wall. And it was mm-hmm. on the FM station. And I was standing there and they announced it. Judy Garland has died. And mm-hmm. I was devastated. And as a 12-year-old, I thought, I'll never meet her now.
Oh,
because
wow.
in my mind, I was going to meet her. I was going to be her friend.
Oh, how and, wonderful.
You know, she had that sort of effect on us.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
So that you picked up the mantle and that you created her fan club is really kind of wonderful. It's astounding.
Well, it is. It amazes me. I mean, of all the people in the world who could or would have done that, I did it, you know? I mean, why is that, you know? When people look back on my life, it's one of the major things I'll be remembered for, which is fine with me, you know?
That is pretty outstanding. That sort of pops up there. You go, well, who would do that? And at 14 years old. Thank you for leading the way and for modeling how it's supposed to be done.
Oh, very nice. Thank you. Like I said, I'm very preoccupied with finding a publisher for my book this year. I really very much want to do that.
Well, we'll look for that because I've read parts of it and it's delicious. Thank you for talking with me. You know, you
a great pleasure. Charlie,
I think
anytime.
Of you as a very courageous man. You've always been nothing less than honest with me in the 20 years I've known you.
Oh.
You talk about artists who are giving, and you are one of the most generous people I've ever met.
One more thing.
Yes,
I'm
please.
I'm very proud to be a blonde.
I will make sure
my hair has been a constant source of joy throughout my life.
You have excellent hair, no doubt.
Thank you. Thank
and,
you.
And thank you. Thank you for today. And I will talk to you very soon.
All right. Mwah. Take care.
Side effects from listening to Take It From the Top include climbing out of a creative rut, getting inspired, and or living the life of your dreams. If these symptoms persist, tell a friend to download the podcast immediately.